It is Saturday, October 12th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 889 and KOSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Right now, I want to welcome into the air room with me, Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hi, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a web instructor and world traveler.
What up? How you doing, Lyle?
Good to see you both. I'm quite well, thank you. All right, Miles, tell us the newest and greatest on energy creation or transformation.
Delivery? On a small scale, on the home level, photovoltaics are pretty cool.
Yeah.
People have them on their roofs quite often.
Solar
I don't.
Panels,
I'd
right?
love to, yeah. And they convert photons into electrical energy directly, electrical current. But once you get past a certain size, they just don't make as much sense.
How so?
Because they require clean rooms to make. They require all of this area in order to do it because you have the solar constant, which is about one kilowatt per square meter.
But we're talking
as a maximum.
The maximum amount of energy you can pull out of a certain area.
Well, yeah, maximum energy in sunlight of a certain area.
Yes,
that hits the ground. Yeah.
Right,
that gets to the ground. It's actually a little bit off from that, but it's like one point something. But with losses and stuff like that, going through clouds and stuff like that, that's about what it is. And then when you talk about a solar panel being 15% efficient, people talk about 15%, 20% efficiency. That means 20% of that 1 kilowatt
right.
per square meter.
Right.
So you're talking about small levels. It's good for small scale, but it's hard to build that out over large areas and expensive to
when,
do so.
When you're doing photovoltaic, taking the sun and transferring right to electricity.
Right.
That's hard at large scale. Well, what about those desert installations that are giant?
No, they do have them. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're expensive. You have to make sure you go out and you clean off the panels and stuff like that. So there's another type of solar which does work well, which doesn't work well at the small scale, but it works wonderfully at the large scale, which is solar thermal, which is you have a you're concentrating heat, the sun's heat, and then turning a turbine.
So these are basically, you've seen them out in the desert, that's kind of what I was just referencing, where you have a whole bunch of mirrors and you push the light, you bounce off the mirrors onto some centralized point and do something in that centralized point.
Right, that's one way of doing it, or a solar tower is another way of doing that, where mm-hmm. the base ends up heating up or being a different temperature differential than the top, and so you spin that way. But yes, this is talking about the mirrors, because mirrors, you don't need a clean room for that.
Right. We know how to do that.
And in fact, over a large area, you don't even necessarily have to make them parabolic because you just have a whole bunch of mirrors that point in generally the same direction. They can be flat, which is so much easier to manufacture than a curved mirror.
Yeah.
And so there actually is an array that is 70 miles southwest of Phoenix, gone live, called the Solana Solar Power Plant. Covers 3 square miles. With
that's a lot of mirrors.
3,200 collectors. Yeah.
Collectors, yeah, cool.
Although these are parabolic. Okay. These are done in such a way that they are trying to get the most you can possibly get out of it.
And they take all that light and put it in one place. What's there? Someone very unhappy?
It's hot there.
Well, that is where they're collecting the heat. And from there, you boil water and you turn a turbine, and that's how most power works. Because you need to, you're basically converting heat to mechanical energy, to chemical energy, and that.
Right.
Mechanical energy. Yeah. Anyway, you have conversion.
Turbines, of course, you spin them, and they're like motors, but they're
that's right.
Current.
How they do it.
Coal powered plants, oil powered plants, natural gas plants, nuclear plants, they're all.
Hydroelectric dams.
Yeah.
That's not hydroelectric. Water, yeah. But they all spin turbines.
Yeah. But the ones that you're causing heat, that what you're doing is you're boiling water to generate steam to spin. A turbine.
Higher pressure to spin the turbine to convert into it. Yeah.
All right. So,
a generator.
So this one that's coming online is one of those that has a whole bunch of collectors, heats up something in the center. I'm assuming it doesn't heat the water directly because that wouldn't be very efficient.
No, it's heating up a liquid sodium bath.
you know, you've talked about that type of thing before on the show.
I remember that. Yeah.
Okay. So it does that because it can get extremely hot, as I recall, right?
Sodium has some drawbacks, which is you don't want to expose it to air.
It's really nasty stuff too, right?
Well,
it's
elements quickly.
Elemental anything. Not anything, but not noble gases, for example.
On that row of the periodic table,
right.
Especially.
But in general, your base elements, they're usually combined with something when you encounter them. So when you have an element by itself that's not a noble gas, for example, they tend to react.
Right.
Sometimes violently.
But the interesting property of this thing, the sodium, that when you heat it up, it becomes liquid. It stays liquid to a high temperature. So they can actually pipe it through other pipes.
The point behind using sodium is that it has a high specific heat, so it retains its heat well. It's like water versus, it's like the ocean versus land. You know how the land heats up quickly but also cools down quickly, and the water takes longer to heat up and then it will cool down. That's talking about specific heat. And
whoa. I always called that thermal inertia because I didn't know the name for it.
I would say thermal inertia makes sense. I mean, it's
a resistance to change in temperature, right?
That's what you can call it. Yeah.
It's called specific heat?
Yeah, that's the term used, at least with regard to meteorology.
I learned so much hanging out with you guys.
Okay, so this new South Arizona array is using sodium. What's new about this power plant?
Because while it's great that we use solar power and we can turn these turbines and we can generate electricity, what happens when the sun goes down? That's always been the problem with
night.
It. And that's
night
the problem with photovoltaics. You know, a cloud goes over and suddenly your potential drops. And so what they're doing is they're heating up this bath so that they're, you know, generating whatever heat they need to generate to boil the water, to turn the turbines, to get up to 280 megawatts of electricity.
That's a big plant.
Which is nice. It's about one-fifth of what a nuclear reactor does, typically, or like one of the reactors at Diablo Canyon will do. But it's still great because it costs $2 billion, which in power plants, that's a reasonable amount, and it's sunlight.
And probably less stuff we have to deal with later by burying under Yucca Mountain.
But that $2 billion also buys us that saltwater bath, which provides that 6 hours of electricity even when the sun isn't shining.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Oh, talk about thermal inertia. Nice. So that bath can stay hot enough to still deal with the steam and everything even after 6 hours of loss of power. So basically, you get, especially in the desert, you're going to let
But it also allows it to equalize so that if you have cloud going overhead or something like
that
you can still equalize that load much easier than you could otherwise. Limited to that.
What's the name of that power plant?
The Solana Solar Plant.
Cool.
Yeah. I've been waiting for one of these to go live for a while. It's pretty exciting technology.
And as a side note, the construction of the plant created more than 2,000 jobs and a national supply chain that spans 165 companies in 29 states.
That's cool.
So
economic
solar,
success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Economic success as well.
That's very cool. Ben, let's talk about automobiles.
Have you heard of computed tomography scanners?
Computed tomography scanners.
Tomography. I don't know
what's tomography.
CT scans.
You jerk.
Anyway, so we know about CT scans. You know, you get into an auto wreck and they take your body, put it into a CT scan, look at your brain or look at whatever and try and figure out what's wrong. But it turns out that you can actually use the same technology on things like the car you crashed to figure out how the car's doing. I mean, because after you crash a car, it's kind of like a bicycle helmet. You drop it, and then you're not positive that it's going to be okay in the future. But it's really difficult to inspect non-destructively. Like your helmet, you can drop it. It looks okay. Well, let me just try and crack it and see.
Its cracking pressure it was okay.
Yeah. If only I'd known that. So that's destructive
testing. So they're doing scans of cars to look for micro freezers or something?
They're just looking for issues, right? Especially if pieces of the structure are bent, they're going to be able to figure out if it's just cosmetic stuff or whatever. Or actually infrastructure of the car, important parts of the car. And actually, the problem with this is that you can't fit a car into a CT scan.
I guess CT scans are not the ones you got to be careful about metal and stuff. They're not like...
they're X-rays.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're basically... it's an X-ray detector or two X-ray detectors, right. depending. But basically, this development center called the Fraunhofer... I can't... My German accent's gone. Right. The Fraunhofer Development Center. They have built a very large CT scanner on with a turntable. So what they do is they drag the car onto the turntable, and then they turn on the two X-rays on either side, and then they turn the turntable around, and they can actually get a three-dimensional scan of a car that's been wrecked or that may okay. have structural issues.
All right, so,
and with really great resolution too, less than a millimeter.
Yeah, but not millimeters. But X-rays reflect off of metal. I mean, it's not. They're going to collide. It's not going to be efficient. I mean, I'm assuming that. Afterwards, the car is going to have serious cancer, right? Because it's going to get bombarded with a level to get the X-ray
reading.
Don't use this car.
It'll perform fine in a crash, but it'll give you cancer.
Yeah. No, it's not ionizing. It's not going to make the car have a problem. But what I'm saying is that if you put a human in the same condition where you covered them in metal and then you tried to scan their tissue inside, that would be bad.
Yeah, so presumably it's a much higher power.
You'd have to, because you're going to get a lot of loss, a lot of
yeah, but they've got some pretty cool pictures of this thing, of the scans of a crashed car.
You know, we spoke so long about the solar array. I'm going to ask you to jump in your next story about money as well.
Sure. Let me just tab on over here. So new $100 bills started to circulate on October 8th. That was just this last Tuesday.
I haven't seen one yet.
That's probably... Well, how much money do you do with a day? Do you regularly deal with $100 bills?
I use these plastic devices that have magnetic strips on them and such.
Wow, that sounds really exciting.
Yeah. I'm not a big spender in the cash world.
Actually, there was another story I'm not going to cover, but it just talks about how fast food is doing really great things, innovative things in terms of paying with your phone.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones you're driving by and just won't beep your phone. Mm-hmm. Better than credit cards. Anyway, $100 bills. Apparently, they are actually the most used bill, more than $20 bills and more. Second used. $1 bills are actually the most used. And that was surprising to me because I would think that
we're running in the wrong circles. What's going on?
People dealing with hundreds of dollars would use cash, right? Would you use credit cards, right? Well, anyway, so that's a fact.
I guess if you mostly use 20s, if you look at the amount of money that gets transferred in 20s, it's probably not as high as the amount in 100s. Because when you actually need to transfer, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, you're going to use 100s. So maybe that's why they say it's the most used. In any case, is this new bill, have you looked at it? Is it cool? Is it
I have not actually seen it, but there's some descriptions in the stories that I'm going to post up on geekspeak.org. Also, one of the cool things about this, or actually one of the upsetting things about this, is this was supposed to come out in early 2011. But it didn't. And the reason was because they had all kinds of interesting issues in production. One of them is they printed a bunch of bills and they had this issue with some of the bills known as mashing. Basically, you put too much ink on a piece of paper or a piece of plastic or whatever, and all the ink kind of smudges together and you get these fuzzy lines. So the idea with a lot of these new features are that you don't want it to be easily counterfeited. And so you want it to be really, really crisp and really, really small.
I love it. So what they do is they design all the technology in the bill to make sure it can't be counterfeited.
And they send
this
it to the printer.
This will be impossible to create. And the printer's like, I can't make these things.
Yeah. Additionally, they also had issues where the bills would fold while they were going through the machines, leaving these blank spots that weren't printed on. So, that was kind of a big
So this bill was delayed for 2 years because it's so hard to make.
Uh-huh. And it cost a lot of money too. Apparently 30 million. Never mind. I can't find the numbers, but basically the error that I was talking about in 2009 took, cost about $3.8 million and it'll cost them another $12,000 to destroy these bills. Apparently it costs 12 cents to make a $100 bill. Who knew? And it costs like 2 cents to make a penny. So,
but it's not a problem because if it costs too much, you just print more of them.
Right.
Exactly. I was just about to say that. It's like, this costs this much, so we printed a little bit more, and now we've paid for
just
it.
Just a bit. How about that?
It's so wrong.
Anyway, so some pretty cool new security features.
Cool, so they're really hard to do.
I'll let you look at pictures online, but things like you change the angle of the bill, and it changes colors.
Don't you guys kind of want to figure out how to counterfeit them? Like, that's my geek brain. I'm like, oh, really? It's that hard. Let me see that thing.
That's one of the problems with being an ethical geek.
Yes.
Is you walk into a supermarket and you're like, it would be so easy to steal this cup of coffee. If only I had the
if only
moral.
I was devious.
Yeah, if only I didn't have morals. Anyway.
All right, thanks for those two stories, Kat. CT scannings of cars and the new very anti-counterfeitable $100 bill, which I look forward to seeing. I'll have to get one soon.
Yeah, and it still has Ben Franklin.
Now, Miles, you and I haven't done a show in a while together, I don't think. And one of the things we talk about every once in a while is security and politics and stuff. And I've been wanting to talk to you a bit about Snowden stuff. And then, of course, that's a little later. But there's some ramifications coming out about what the government's actually doing with regards to snooping and such. And you've got an interesting story on that. Let's talk about that one.
Are you referring to Lavabit?
I am referring to Lavabit.
Lavabit is or was an email service made available to people basically with the thought process of all the stuff's encrypted, it's completely safe, even from the administrators of Lavabit.
Okay, and we're going to continue the story on how that got broken to some degree in just a minute. Stay with us here on KOSP and GeekSpeak. This is GeekSpeak on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. And I want to point to another wonderful GeekSpeak, or excuse me, KOSP program called The Seventh Avenue Project. The acclaimed essayist Richard Rodriguez on faith, love, and loss. In a wide-ranging conversation with host Robert Pauly, Rodriguez reflects on being gay and Catholic, on the kinship of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and how the new atheists misunderstand religion. That's tomorrow at noon on The Seventh Avenue Project. Of course, you can also get the podcast of that from kosp.org. All the stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak is available at geekspeak.org a little bit after the program airs. Ben, you got a geek bit for us?
Got a quick geek bit. Do you remember back in 2009 when I covered a story, I think also a geek bit, about this weird spiral that appeared in
yes.
the Norway sky? It was actually a Russian rocket launch.
With a side leak that caused
yeah.
the spin and produced a really cool
it
effect.
Was really, sure. really neat. Well, there's another one, and this one is an intercontinental ballistic missile. So knowing that, the image is a little bit harrowing, but
is it armed?
It's probably not.
Okay, good.
Whenever people say armed, I always imagine arms on it, like the right to
that
bear
would make
arms.
It spin really bad.
Anyway,
right, so
I
cool
want to
pictures.
Hear about the story.
Yes, yes,
about.
We'll go into that. So cool pictures up on GeekSpeak.
It will be
once you get it up, and we'll link to the last geek bit as well up on the show. Okay,
absolutely.
So Miles, Lavabit, an email service provided that specifically designed it such that even the administrator themselves couldn't get access to the person's emails.
Right. The data was stored in the database encrypted.
Right.
With a key that was controlled by the user.
Right. So basically, if I were a user of the system, mail would come in. Immediately, it would get encrypted and stored in the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And no logs of it besides that one process of it coming in. And once it was there, the administrator, they'd look inside the database, they'd see files for me, but they'd only be randomized. They'd be completely impossible.
Yeah, that wouldn't be real.
And then when I log into that system, I use my password, and in that process, I download it, and I can actually...
I believe you also have your own key that you associated with it, so
right.
you actually have a client certificate.
And the whole point of this was to have to, a lot of its feature set was really like, if you want really secure privacy, use me.
Right. This was... The founder really did care about... privacy. That was the solution he was trying to solve. He wasn't trying to give email. He was trying to solve the problem with email. And then suddenly he put up a message saying, I'm shutting down Lavabit. And people were like, what? What's going on here? And a story, stuff started.
And he ran this company for 10 years. It wasn't like a...
Right.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he just walks away from it. And people are like, what's going on with this? And after some investigation from some journalists, found out that it's because the FBI had wanted access to the system to surveil on one or more of his users. And he had a problem with having a blank statement. But he also, the issue with Lavabit was the administrators don't have direct access.
Right.
So
he couldn't
he was
give
saying,
them what he wanted.
Yeah, you can't have access to all this because I can't give it to you. Said, okay, well, that's fine. Turn over your root SSL certificate, the certificate that you're using to sign all of the client certificates, and that'll be enough.
Right. And what that would allow to happen is any of the traffic that goes in and out from his server, you could grab a copy of and decrypt it and see it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a security problem with his design that in as much as the decryption and such actually happened on his machines. So from what I understood, one of the things he said is, I could build a system in place that allow you to target a customer and say, we want that person's customer, you know, information. And after court order, I could give that to you. But that system's not in place because I designed it not to be that way. So I have to do that. I'd have to do a lot of work and therefore compensate me or something like that. And they said, no, don't worry about it. Just give us access to everything willy-nilly, which is basically what they asked for, right?
Right.
And of course,
they wanted the master keys.
We only know this.
The service went offline because otherwise they would probably be able
to. Well, they basically said, give us the SSL keys. Well, I don't want to do that. Give us the SSL keys or we'll throw you in jail.
Right. And he protested for a while and finally lost.
And he said, okay, here's the SSL certificate. And then immediately said, okay, everyone, I'm shutting down LavaBit.
Right. And he shut it down. So that therefore...
Because I can't...
Because
he couldn't, in good conscience, keep running the service that he knew was being surveilled. Because the whole point behind the service was that you couldn't be surveilled.
Right. The other thing that's interesting about this is he couldn't talk about this. The reason we know about this is because of other court papers that became public record because it was a court. Right? So journalists actually looked at the papers to find it. He was gagged. He couldn't talk about any of this. All he could say is, I'm shutting it down. I don't feel comfortable. He had a great little statement that was like, what? Like, it didn't have enough information. Then if you read it intelligently, you're like, oh, he can't say what he needs to say, so this is what he's saying. The other thing, you know how he actually gave him the cert?
I didn't catch that one, no.
Okay. You ever used four-point font? Because he printed the whole thing in four-point font. It was 9 pages long. And he handed it to them. There you go. And it's small enough where you can actually, human can read it, but OCR can't get it. So you'd have to type it. And even if you type the entire thing, if you made one mistake, useless. So he basically still, and the lawyer was like, yeah, that's fine. There's no problem with that. The other thing, of course, is that once he shuts it down, it's not useful anyway, unless they've been logging all that data the whole time anyway. So anyway, the thing that's creepy about this is we had a person whose business model was, I want to provide security for you in the cloud, you know. Mm-hmm. Small company, didn't have large lawyers, right? In fact, he actually used a lot of people had bought the service for long periods of time to actually, you know, help subsidize it. And he used all the money in the company, basically went bankrupt while doing this kind of legal thing. But the thing that's so frustrating about this is that they didn't win. They didn't get the government didn't get what they wanted. He didn't get, you know, success. Mm-hmm. The customers lost. Like, everybody lost in this scenario, which is really
interesting. And the predominant theory is that the customer they were asking for was Edward Snowden.
That is the theory, yeah.
So that and opens up a whole other can of worms of discussion, which we could save for some other time.
Yeah, I guess we could.
Could be an entire episode, actually.
In what
is the discussion of Snowden security? That's the fallout having to do with that, the ramifications of the prosecution and pursuit of him.
Yeah, it's kind of a creepy situation. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's a mess.
All right. Thank you very much for that story. That the LavaBit story was fascinating. And, of course, we'll have links to this. That's Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. And, Ben, let's get back to kind of medical things, I guess.
Are you talking about tactile feedback stuff?
No, I was talking about haptic. Haptic.
Haptic feedback?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Haptic.
See, I thought it was filters. Sorry.
No.
That's HEPA.
HEPA.
This is nothing of the sort. This is talking about tactile feedback. So a lot of the times they'll talk about tactile feedback as you're holding your phone, you press a little soft button, like a button on the screen, and the phone will make a very slight vibration. Mm-hmm. And that way you can it indicates to you that it's that something has happened.
It's about giving touch as a feedback.
Absolutely. Okay. The same thing actually happens every day, every Saturday at 10 a.m., I get a little vibration, which indicates GeekSpeak has started, and I'm going into silent mode. And then at the end, it vibrates, shows over. So that's kind of cool. The problem with this is if you are touching a touchscreen, you're covering the thing that you want to touch. And so one of the ideas is, what if we could somehow provide haptic feedback off of the screen, above the screen? And there's actually a way of doing that, and it has to do with sound. Any ideas?
Colliding two sound waves at the right spot.
I didn't tell you that.
No.
Very nicely done. Yeah, it's interference patterns. So
throw out enough words and it'll come out correct eventually.
As an example, if you're listening to music and there's, let's say, the bass player and the song is playing a long sustaining note, if you move around the room, sometimes you'll actually hear kind of whoa, whoa, mm-hmm. and that's from the bass, the waves of the bass coming out of the speakers and bouncing off the walls and creating these interference patterns.
Right.
If you want a graphic of that, you can search for Google Images for interference patterns. The same thing happens with light. Same things happens with
pool
waves
of water,
in the ocean.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool. As it turns out, you can actually create these nodes where there's a lot of low vibration by colliding two very high sounds.
Mm-hmm.
High sounds are directional, which means that they can be very specifically pointed.
High frequencies.
Yeah. So basically, if you have two speakers and they're both providing these high frequency tones, and they collide at a specific point.
You deal with their phase. You fluctuate their phases to actually move that nodal point mm-hmm. around.
Exactly. Yeah. So you fluctuate the phases so that way and the sounds are just slightly off mm-hmm. from each other. So anyway,
feel that?
You can actually feel it. Yeah. It's the air in that little space is moving around.
So you started talking about touch surfaces. So I'm imagining a phone. So I'm imagining a phone having enough power to do that. It seems like much more.
We're talking more like a tablet, maybe.
Yeah. Or even a large surface like feedback system for Microsoft's X. What's the thing that I'm blanking?
I know what you're talking
Kinect,
about too.
Kinect.
Yeah, the
thank
Kinect.
You. So the Kinect, of course, does scanning, but there's no feedback in that system where you're just dancing around. But if you had speaker systems, you could actually produce these nodal points to give you feedback. That's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. So this
touch
is
feedback.
Just this is another Lego piece in all of these pieces
cool.
that we have. We've got the displays. We've got a tracking for following your fingers around, figuring out how far you are away from the screen, and now we also have a haptic feedback. So one of the this is a. Britain's University of Bristol, and it's kind of a proof of concept. Actually isn't in a device yet. But the video that they have that shows it, they have a YouTube-looking video, and you can hover your finger over, feel where the play button is. Your finger is floating in midair, but you can feel where
the play
button is.
What's the hardware they're using?
It's two speakers.
Okay, so you can't run this, but you can see a video of somebody else doing it.
Exactly.
And having their feeling. So they might be lying to you.
They might. Yeah, they're waving their hand in the air. They're
like,
oh, I feel it here.
Yeah.
But they could be making that up. I don't know.
That's awesome.
And then you tap on it.
Of course, it takes 15 megawatts to make this work. I got to say, it's not going to be efficient, but it's really cool.
There's one other example that I talked about a couple years ago as well, in throwbacks to old stories, where there was this advertisement up on this billboard, and it was for some kind of a ghost thing. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And so you'd be walking down the street, and suddenly you'd walk into this little zone where those ultrasound speakers were focusing, and you could started hearing these voices, these whispering voices, and you're turning around looking for it, and there's nobody there.
Did we have those ultrasound speakers when you worked for me at UCSC?
You did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those things are really cool, and they basically are an array of little speakers, and they produce high frequency that then cancels out, and you can hear tonal. Which is basically a cone of sound, which is really kind mm-hmm. of creepy
it's
when you
a,
get in front of it.
It's a cone of full spectrum sound.
It's the same stuff that is used in military applications for disabling people's hearing long ways away.
God.
Yeah, because it's directional. And you can do, you know.
There, unfortunately, there are all sorts of
fun. You can always weaponize
horrifying.
Cool technology, can't you?
Yeah. You can get huge subwoofers and blast a specific frequency, and then people will start vomiting in a crowd. Right? That's one way you could do crowd control. It's kind of horrible, but. Anyway, I mean, the technology is technology.
Okay, thanks. And you'll have more information about this up at geekspeak.org.
Absolutely, there's
and
a video.
I would argue the one thing you can't really weaponize is communication. But maybe you can. I don't know. But let's move forward.
I don't know. Maybe.
Miles, tell us this wonderful story. I love that the subject I have written down is passwords.
No.
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Okay.
This is our favorite topic on GeekSpeak. There is a full password episode. If this isn't enough for you.
You know what? That episode's actually really quite highly downloaded. Not as much as like our big, when we had famous people on, like the, Waz being on the show. That one's, I think, highest, and then Lightroom and stuff. But
actually,
the password show is 8 or 7. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, this story now basically says, our password show.
Useless.
Don't bother anymore. I really hate to say it because we don't have much that's better.
We will
passwords soon. Are almost useless.
And I don't mean that in terms of you should, you know, forget using a password anymore and don't use, use the internet
anymore. I want to ask a question. You say passwords are almost useless. Do you mean in general, or do you mean against people looking for very specific information? Because if I have an email account and I'm some social activist and the government really wants to get my email, they could probably do it if I just have a password in the way. But if I'm just some Joe Schmo with my email, passwords are going to keep most people out, right?
Good question. Okay, Miles?
If you're going to a website and you're out on the front side of a website and trying passwords, most good websites will, well, one, just by virtue of the fact that the website is physically detached from where your location is, you're going to have that latency. There's a certain number of passwords they can give at any given time to try it out, assuming they know the username. And good sites will actually delay the tries,
right,
and only allow you to try at a certain rate.
And then might even like turn off trying for 20 minutes.
Right.
If there's six failures.
But the news constantly has stories of hacking in, sites have been hacked into and they get credit card numbers like that. They'll generally also get a password list, and that password list will be hopefully encrypted. If it's an MD5 password list, then you're kind of hosed. Hopefully the site administrator has done something better than that. But even if they have, if they have access to the encrypted password list, it's over.
The password's
game
open.
Is over, because it doesn't matter anymore that you used a phrase. It doesn't matter anymore that you used a phrase that is 20 characters long.
Why?
Because the ability now for password crackers to get into that system has now surpassed it.
Yeah. We talked about this, right?
Right.
The idea that if you think you're being clever with a pattern or something, you're not. The computers are faster. And we've talked about length. You know, make a long phrase. It makes harder and harder. But now what you're saying is the cracking hardware is so good that it doesn't matter what length it is anymore.
Right.
If it's something that can fit in your brain, it's too small.
Right. And let me give you an example of a password that is in this list that they found. Like, this is... These are examples of passwords that we found, and I'll link to the story.
So this password's bad.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Well, this password didn't work in one instance.
Now listen.
Right.
Okay, yeah, right, right. Yeah.
YU891230@(#%)%.
That, which sounds like a really good password, is no good.
Failed.
Failed because they were able to crack it quickly?
They're using a variety of different techniques, but basically one of the things they were doing was they went to this group from the article I'm going to link to and be up on GeekSpeak after the show is up, is they looked at the content from USA Today articles and then moved on to they looked at the entire contents of Wikipedia and the first 15,000 works in Project Gutenberg. So instead of taking just random characters like what a computer would go through, they took the corpus of what is basically human knowledge, looked to see what the patterns are for humanity, what human beings put in.
But is that password show up in that corpus of information? Is that like a password from a novel?
I actually don't know in that particular instance.
Yeah, why is that password
But
packable?
They're taking variations of that. They're looking to see what number of patterns tend to show up more often than others.
Right.
What are things? Because those are the passwords we choose. What are the patterns that we recognize that we can reproduce after the fact? And it's really sad. So that now, my advice to you is, if you have a site that allows for things like two-factor authentication, and you may not have ever heard that term before. If you've listened to the show, you've heard that term before. But you may not even know what that is. But if it says something like two-factor authentication or something like that, that goes beyond a password, please use it.
Okay.
We are now at the point now, where you need
to take that extra step. The other argument against this is if you have a computer generate a random string of 30 characters, that password will be pretty good. So just do that. But you can't remember that.
I mean, if you have one password.
No, I mean,
if you have the program one password.
Right. I use one password.
There's
other
manager,
ones too.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically the idea is that every time I use a password on a site, it's 20 characters long. It's random. And I can't type it. Like, I don't, that's the problem with it, is that I can't type those. So the ones that I need to put into my phone, I have problems with, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I'll spend 20 minutes trying to sign. I just won't even be able to skip it. But that's the idea, is that you always use a random long number, which you can't memorize.
Right.
And that's why it's not really a password, because it's not something I remember. It's a key. You know, it's like something else, because it's not something I remember.
But they're printable characters, which mm-hmm. means that you're using less than the 8-bit field from there. So you're talking about a base, I don't know, 96...
Yeah, 96 characters, 20 long. That'll do it.
So 96 to 20
really
is power.
Hard. And but more importantly,
but it isn't though, because now we have systems where if you had an array of computers, like something that an individual could buy, it would be very expensive. But array of computers that have, say, 4 high-powered video cards with high-powered GPUs in parallel,
make a supercomputer
each, you're able to get these key sets.
Yeah. Okay, and there's hardware level burns of these too, right? You can build this into hardware and get faster than those graphics cards too.
Yeah.
Yep. So just thinking, so you're depressing.
Thinking of your password isn't enough. Look for help. That can be 2-factor authentication. It can be things like you have with 1Password, which will do better than the
or LastPass, another one, which I think is actually a free version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do want to just give a little perspective and say that just because a password, any particular password, can be cracked, doesn't mean that you shouldn't be using strong passwords. So everything that we've been saying still does apply, but if there is a particular reason someone's trying to get after your data and they decide to buy some machines and target you, then maybe a password won't do it. So yeah, 2-factor authentication, definitely.
And, you know, I think one of the things we've talked about passwords for a long time is this idea that there's a human memory, you know, level that you can't surpass. Like, our brains can only do certain things. Computers at some point are just going to be able to do it better.
So actually, the average tends to be 7 digits. Which
7 digits.
Why phone numbers are that long.
It's basically kind of useless for us to try to memorize things. Now, there's ways of doing that. There's a great XKCD thing where you just take a whole bunch of nouns and put a picture in your head and then you use those nouns.
Which is now not good.
Totally not work. Right. Yeah. That's the thing that won't work. But even if we got to a point where we could kind of figure out a pattern that kind of works, it's just a matter of time before it won't work again. Right? Like, the human brain's not going to do it. But we are starting to be... So you could theoretically assume that at some point you would have to you'd have to have a periphery that's a computer that can help you with this kind of thing. And that's kind of what we have now, right? Everybody has mobile devices that potentially could be supporting you. So, like, my phone provides me random password stuff. I've got a tool in the system. I have to trust it. And I think that's kind of fascinating, that we're getting to the point where our technology level needs to be assisted. Chess is another one of these examples, right? We know that we can have computer chess programs that can beat the experts on playing chess. But if you give that expert a relatively simple laptop application, it can beat the computer. You know, the human can beat the computer. So if you augment the human, you get something stronger than the computer by themselves. Kind of interesting idea. Anyway.
Which is why you're wearing a wearable computer on your head right now.
Yes, that's why I wear it.
You mentioned XKCD. I just want to point out an interesting news item, which is that Randall Monroe, the guy who writes XKCD, for those of you who don't know, it's a webcomic, and XKCD is a webcomic, and it is the only comic that I read. I don't really like comics, but that one is so good. If you're a geek, you'll probably love it. He now has an asteroid named after him.
Oh, cool.
It's named Monroe. And, of course, given that fact, he decided to do a comic about it. And he writes that if you trip and fall while walking on his asteroid, it'll take you about a minute to hit the ground. And if you jog really fast, then you'll probably go into orbit.
Yeah.
So,
speaking of orbit around asteroids, Miles got a movie recommendation for us?
Gravity. And I haven't seen the movie yet. I've only seen the trailer. And it's funny that I would give this recommendation, and yet I tend to think of it in terms of reputation. Mm-hmm. Like, many people will look to Siskel and Ebert back in the day, or Ebert and Robert, or
what do you look for alive? For recommendations for films?
When they're science fiction, I look for people who are in the field. If it's a movie about space, I want to know what the astrophysicists think of it. And astrophysicists that I've been seeing that are in the public eye, people like Phil Plait and Neil deGrasse Tyson, have been effusive in their praise of this
film.
Just saying, this is a great film. Yes, here we're going to nitpick these things that couldn't happen, which is always fun.
I saw some of the trailer. I'm like, no.
This is when they got the science wrong.
Right, but most of it's right.
Yes.
Okay, good.
And demonstrably right. And the parts where they got it wrong, it wasn't because they didn't care. It was because
it's
you only have 2 hours yeah. to get this movie out or to have people sit through that, and they have to be entertained by it.
All right, cool. So we'll have to all see Gravity and give our opinion later as well. Thank you. Thank you, Miles. So since we were talking about comics, and I can't believe you don't read more comics. What's wrong with you? Have you read the Bone series?
Have you noticed I'm an outlier? I'm on a radio show called Geek Speak.
Tell us about art then.
All right. Well, art. Let's talk about hand stencils that were found in caves in France and Spain from a long time ago. These are things that archaeologists have found.
What, did they tell stories with pictures?
Yeah. Actually.
Oh, were they comics? You liar.
Oh, you set me up for that one, didn't you?
No, go on. What about this cave art?
So yeah, all of these hand stencils on cave walls, the prevailing assumption has been that it's been men who have done it. One of the reasons is that a lot of these early paintings show game animals and like horses and mammoths and things like that. And it would make sense that, you know, men would go out, do hunting, come back and draw pictures of the things that they killed and things like that. But as it turns out, a vast majority of them, about 3/4 of the handprints that were on these walls were female.
Oh, cool.
And it turns out, I was just thinking about women in tech, you know, like that whole thing that's going on right now. And the discrimination that happens there. I mean, you find it also in the scientific literature.
That's
here
cool.
And there.
How they knew it was women. That was something that was more interesting to me.
They knew.
We will
was
tell
women.
You that in just a moment. Okay, Ben, how do we know that these hands are female hands on these ancient cave drawings?
Apparently, and I didn't know this, but if you just find a woman and a man and you compare hands, you'll find that women tend to have ring and index fingers of about the same length, and men's ring fingers tend to be longer than their index fingers. And
the geeks
we're
get
all
quiet.
Standing here looking at our hands.
Huh. Cool. So,
Can I see your hand, Miles?
A comparison, generally these hands have the characteristics that we see more in females, so therefore can assume that most of them are female.
You have a very effeminate hand, Miles.
I have been told this. I've actually been referred to as elegant hands. But
very elegant.
Whatever works, man.
Anyway, that's my news story.
Thank you.
But
that's cool.
There was another aspect to this that I thought was interesting, which is they can also tell by size, not just the overall dimensions, that sexual dimorphism, that difference in shape between, or sizes and shape between men and women, was more pronounced
at
in prehistoric times than it is today.
That kind of makes sense. Yeah, cool. So what you're saying is like the aspect of the male being a little larger and a little stronger is in our society now lessened than it used to be in
yes.
other times. And which makes sense because, of course, we have a lot. We have
tools,
millions of years of tools and so on
that
have kind of neutralized. That's cool. Of course, I would assume diet as well. Well,
diet affected everyone.
Everybody. Well, no, it would partially affect those that had different attributes, right? I mean, depending on your attribute, you'd potentially get better fed in the society.
Yeah, we're totally hypothesizing in a field we know nothing
about.
So
you can call us with something we do know about if you'd like. The phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877. All eight of them. 1-800-655-5877. Who was saying that seven numbers were
all
the,
eight of them?
Well,
10 of them, you mean?
There are the
11 of them.
Well,
one.
Seven numbers was the reason why the original phone numbers were.
Thank you.
And also,
everyone knows a toll free number is 800. So all you have to remember is 655-5877.
Everybody knows their area code, at least before
populations. That was the idea.
Yeah, but now in Silicon Valley, it's just really hard. They have a new one, apparently, and
now,
it overlaps. And, it's
and Ben, I mean,
confusing.
You know that you don't have to use an area code, right, if you're in a certain area? Is that true for you? So when I was growing up, I never dialed phones with area codes.
That's not true in some cases.
Yes,
I can't tell you exactly what cases, but that's definitely not true in some cases. Some cases you do need an area code.
I feel like our entire show is based upon first world problems.
800-655-5877. Again, that's 800-655-5877. We can answer any question you'd like. If you'd like us to be experts on our answer, you might want to be around computers or programming or computer programming. Of course, we talk about a lot of things.
I'm music.
655-5877. Miles, you have a specialty besides computers? Politics. Yeah? Ben's got...
I'm a hack everywhere.
Yeah, me too.
So, I do want to talk about the Red Cross. I just want to make sure I get the story out while we're waiting for phone calls to come in. the Red Cross. Why is Geek Speak talking about the Red Cross? Because they're talking about video games. Wait, that doesn't help. Well, the Red Cross wants video game manufacturers to be responsible for consequences. And but it's not in an MPAA kind of way, or it's not in a we want these computer game manufacturers to face consequences because they're making antisocial games. More to the point, it's games like Battlefield and their ilk and the Call of Duty series. What they want is those video game producers to make video games that have consequences for essentially war crimes. That, yes, you're playing like you're a soldier, but there wants there to be, if you are doing something that is a deliberate attack on a civilian or attacks on medical units,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that, that there to be repercussions in the game yeah. for doing that.
Well, wait, I've played some of these first-person shooters, granted not for a while, but sometimes part of the mission was if you hurt civilians, you get reprimanded later, or you even lose the game. I mean, that's, yeah, sometimes that's part of it,
yeah,
but not a lot of these.
But not in the high-profile ones, never in, like, Battlefield.
Right, and those ones you just murder anybody, and yeah.
And, in fact, if you had you didn't have dedicated medical professionals in those games, you had someone who was a medic who could...
Right, and they were just as... targetable as anybody else. Yeah.
Right. And if someone was going and healing people, you specifically took out the person who was healing people because they were healing people and bringing them back.
In fact, that's a game mechanic. What's the Team Fortress 2? That's like a major game mechanic. If you're mm-hmm. playing that game, you have to kill the medic first. Like that's so the Red Cross is saying, look, these games should represent war crimes.
Right. If you're going to have these war games, if you're going to have them where they are simulations of real world war,
add in the political...
Which is the draw. That's what they're saying. That Battlefield 4 is like you're there in battle, only you're in your mom's basement. And I'm sorry. I just had to do that little crack there.
You know, it wasn't as funny when you didn't have your own house in your own family. Now it's funny, huh?
Speaking of someone who has played an extensive number of games
from their mother's basement.
Well, no, my mom didn't have. I grew up in California. We don't have basements.
I don't even know what a basement is.
I played in your basement.
Yeah, that's true. All right, I think we've got a question via the phone. Is that good? You want to wrap that up?
No, I think that basically covers it. The story will be up on geekspeak.org.
This is Geekspeak. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome.
Hi. I have a printer question.
Oh, my favorite topic.
I know, right? So I have a relatively new computer, just under a year old, laptop, and an oldish printer, about 5 years old. And my computer doesn't have a disk drive, so I just connected them, the printer to the computer.
We can solve this problem. I'm so excited.
Yeah, and it has the model before my my computer shows the model before my printer and the model after my printer, but it doesn't show the model of my printer.
How close is the model number? What printer is this? Is this an H? What model? What company?
The printer is a HP. HP.
I've never heard of that.
Numbers.
HP Babadabada. That's about as much information as I needed.
Okay.
So an HP Babadabada is going to what's happening probably is they...
Oh, it's a C4 280.
Okay, a Babadabada. So have you gone to their website and actually tried to find the driver?
I did.
Okay. And so what you were able to find is one that's after it and one that's before it, but that's not one that's exactly it. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So in this situation, what I do is I go ahead and I do some trial and error. I'll try the one after it. Now, if you think mm-hmm. that the drivers are on that disk, if it's 5 years old, that probably won't help you very much anyway, because the drivers that are on that disk might not be compatible with your operating system now.
Okay.
So that's why it's like not so helpful.
And one of the great things about HP printers in general is that they, without exception, will support PCL5.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is going to be some driver that you can use with that printer. There will always be a basic lingua franca.
In fact, you can just try one of those other ones and see how it goes. Now, you're going to have some features that might not work, right? It might have some extra features like a scanner that you might not be able to get to, depending. But the thing is, a manufacturer like HP, when they invest all this energy in making a driver for a printer, they don't change a lot of it very much. Like, the only thing they're really changing is the model number so they can trick people into buying more. I'm sorry.
Right.
Get people to buy more.
Uh-huh.
And differentiate the ink, you know, to make it more expensive for everybody.
Right.
But really, with the drivers at a core level...
Incentivize their
the
bank accounts?
Yeah. So I highly recommend you try the printer model that's closest that you can get.
Okay.
And, you know, what you're going to know is pretty quickly if it prints or not. And, it, you know, it's $100 bills.
You will not hurt your computer by installing a printer driver that doesn't work with
your
printer.
That was going to be my other question. If I install the wrong one, do I have to reinstall it, or will it automatically get overwritten by the one that does work?
What actually happens with this is an OS, this is Macintosh?
No, this is an Asus.
Okay. So in a Windows environment, you're actually going to add printer profiles to the printer list in the control panel.
Okay.
You just add a whole bunch of them. So the one you choose is the one that's going to work. Yeah. So you can have 15 different drivers for that one printer. Once you figure out which one works, delete the other one so you don't go insane.
Okay.
You say something else?
Yeah, the actual physical driver on the system, like for the same printer model, it will overwrite it. Yeah. But if it's for a different printer model, it'll just sit alongside it.
Yeah.
And it just goes like, hey, I'm ready to print a Braga Schmaga as opposed to a Shiga Schmaga.
Yeah, exactly. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay. Yeah, you won't hurt your computer. And the only... Oh, one thing, Rebecca, I hope you're still listening. Make sure you're ready to unplug that printer, because if you start pinching out pages, you know, one page with one character on it over and over again, it's going to be a big waste. You unplug your machine, unplug the printer, no problem. Well, this has been another wonderful episode of GeekSpeak. Miles Elam, thank you so much for being here.
And my pleasure.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, thank you so much.
Sure.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. It is used with permission. We are Creative Commons Attribution 3, which means if you want to use our content for anything you'd like, please do so. Just give us some attribution when you do that. Thanks to Rick Philman for answering the phones, and thanks to all you guys for being here and for listening to GeekSpeak. Thank you so much. If you'd like to know more information about GeekSpeak or rate us on iTunes and stuff to share the love, please do so. You can go ahead and learn more about us at geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell.